I don't usually get to tell the story of a romance on this podcast, but I've got one today. A romance between two people and between the two people and their work. It's also the story of brutality and survival, as well as collaboration and caregiving among animals in the wild. Derek and Beverly Joubert have been together for over 40 years, and for most of them, they've lived in the most remote, unpopulated areas of Africa, filming lions and other large predators.
Working with these lions and hyenas, we got so attached to them and they got so used to us that in the low moments when there wasn't a battle going on, they would sleep underneath the vehicle. And so we had these animals around us all the time. Very often we found out that we could actually sleep in our vehicle, an open vehicle, no doors, no roof, with the lions sleeping underneath the vehicle and around us. And we were attuned to them getting up and moving and greeting. That would wake us up, and then we'd all go on the hunt together. So we were embedded in a sort of war correspondent way, embedded in the lion pride.
Derek and Beverly Joubert are filmmakers, conservationists, and National Geographic explorers in residence. And they're the subject of today's episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. And if you want to know what it takes to survive being gored by an irate buffalo, stay tuned. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adam A., this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Going out into the field, into the bush, is a place that philosophers and poets have gone to for hundreds of years to get away from the clutter of the city. And to create, and to think, and to be closer to their gods or God or their spirit beings, but to find themselves. And you don't find that in amongst clutter.
If you could dream up your own National Geographic explorers, they'd probably look something like Derek and Beverly. When you start watching any of their 30 films, it is nearly impossible to look away. The characters, the family lineage, the drama, the brutality, like Game of Thrones, only much prettier and furrier. Oh, look, there's the cutest lion cub you've ever seen, a little hesitant to take its first steps into the water. And oh my God, he's just been chomped by a crocodile. The Jouberts never flinch, though. They get closer than you can imagine. They stay put and they keep on shooting, revealing the daily struggles and battles going on in the wild, often at night, unseen by other humans. Situations that would scare the life out of any normal person are right where they want to be, together. It's been that way almost since the day they met, or I should say re-met, when they sat down with Washington Post reporter Mary Jordan in 2018 to record an interview for the Academy of Achievement. They explained that they'd known each other in high school growing up in South Africa, but they didn't start dating until after Derek came back from his 2 years of compulsory military training, when they ran into each other in a shop. That was over 40 years ago. A few years later, married, they saw their first lions together at a safari lodge.
Around about 1881, Derek and I went to Botswana on a holiday trip, really. It was an exploration, adventure trip. And it was really canoeing in the Okavango Delta. And we immersed ourselves in the most incredible, true wilderness. I had no idea that what we had thought was true wilderness was totally different. And it was an exciting trip. We, you know, bathed in the Okavango, probably foolish at the time with all the crocodiles, and really realized that we wanted to make Botswana our home. And it didn't take long. It probably took about 6 months, and we were back in Botswana. We joined a lion research station. It was called the Chobe Lion Research. And that's what we did. We did for many years. And the lion research was all researching lions mainly at nighttime, observing them, because these lions were truly nocturnal, sort of 80% nocturnal, unlike many other places in Africa.
So I think for us it really was about exploring, going out into that heart of Africa, as Beverly says, within that first trip into Botswana, and then realizing that what we had thought was wild was not that wild. And we needed to go wilder. We needed to go deeper into Africa. And I think it speaks to both of our needs to understand the continent we were born on.
Tell us about the magic of Botswana and kind of what it looks like for those who are listening who will never get there.
Well, Botswana has many faces. But the part of it that we love most is in the Okavango. And in the northern regions where there are a huge variety of wildlife, big herds of elephants, probably one-third to arguably half of the world's elephants there. And for me, it's the smell of the wild sage and the elephant dung and the mud and the flood that just conjures up that wild place.
And then putting us into our work there, I mean, we truly are discovering things that have never been seen before. Especially the nocturnal work. We were working with sort of 30 lions in a pride and a hyena clan of about 40 or 50, and they would come in and challenge the lions at nighttime, and we were watching battles that we had never ever dreamt would happen. And in fact, I mean, East Africa, when we spoke about it to the other scientists, they said it's impossible. We see lions and hyenas lying together in the shade during the day. It could never happen. And that's really when we picked up cameras. We decided we had to document everything we were seeing so that it was really evident to all scientists through Africa.
What year was that around?
That was probably...
1982.
Around about 1982.
But we'd sort of stepped into a war zone there. We didn't expect to. We sort of fell in love with the beauty of this place. But two things were going on. One is the Savudi Channel where we were camped was drying up. So when these rivers dry up, everything is in conflict. Yeah. Everything's around them. So we stepped right into that and then almost immediately into these epic battles between lions and hyenas that nobody in the world had seen before.
How close were you to these epic, dangerous battles?
We were in the middle of them.
You know, sometimes we wouldn't push ourselves in, but they would come closer and closer to us. They got so used to us being out there nightly. We did that solidly for 7 years. And I can tell you, sleep deprivation is extreme. It really does make you go a little bit crazy. But we realized that what we were seeing was so unique and that nobody had ever seen it before, that we needed to keep going. We needed to document. But I think at the same time, funny that, you know, you get so immersed in what you're doing that I think the daily adrenaline rushes that we were getting with the animals, I mean, these battles were intense. We could pick up what the lions were feeling. And then, of course, that aggression, you know, of the hyenas. And I think... we started off, you know, it was a great adventure and intrigued, and then passion took over, immense passion, and we couldn't stop. And even though we were totally exhausted a lot of the time, we just couldn't stop. And so the only way we could see it is, you know, this became an incredible obsession that we had to discover and unveil what was going on.
But what about the danger? I mean, it sounds so magical, but on the other hand, it sounds a little crazy.
It was totally crazy. Well... I think it's good to be a little crazy, isn't it?
You know, I have to say, though, many will say, oh, so romantic, you know, living out the way you do, just the two of you out in the field. And, you know, that's really, it was our desire to be able to be together and work together and share the patterns together. So yes, very magical in that way, but incredibly hard. You know, we would often be, through that time, we would work from 4 in the afternoon until 9 in the morning. And granted, we might have got, you know, an hour's sleep through the night, but an hour's sleep is not great for the logging of memory on the, in the brain. And then we would try and sleep during the day. Then our lives changed, and now we work for 18 hours a day and manage to sleep through the night. But you are being physical at all times.
Just talk about the physical part of this. So where did you keep your food? In the truck?
Yeah.
So we've designed many vehicles, and one design leads to the next over the years. But within the vehicle itself, we treat it like a ship or like a boat or a yacht. So everything has its place. Camera has a cutout where the camera goes. Lenses. Knives, axes, food, everything is in that vehicle so that we can reach over in the dead of night and pick up something. We know the axe is there or the lens is there or where the food is, so that if it's chaotic, then your life is chaotic and actually quite dangerous.
Is there something that you kept in the truck that we might not expect?
Gosh. The complete works of Shakespeare.
Seriously?
Yeah. For us, what we do, and very often with just a candle, I'd read Shakespeare to Beverly and start at the beginning and end up at the end of the complete works and then start again.
Keep in mind, it's not like they had space in the vehicle for an extensive library. It was, after all, both their home, their office, and their film studio. Most people who visit the bush go for a few days or a week or two and can suspend their daily routines. But they lived there for years, decades, so they had to figure out how to stay clean and healthy and how to do exercise even while living in proximity to elephants, buffalo, hyenas, and big cats.
You know, I've always done yoga, so I would either get on the top of the vehicle and I could do my sun salutations on the top of the vehicle. I remember a key moment when we were filming A Little Leopard, and she was reclined in the tree, and she was there for hours and hours and hours. And often you could be there, you know, through the whole day. And that is a time that, you know, sitting patiently, we would do a few things, but obviously never wanting to disturb the animals around us. So I got out of the vehicle, and I just did everything where she couldn't see me. And that's the sort of thing we would do. You would, you know, just do
sit-ups. So same thing, this little leopard would eventually come underneath the vehicle if it was a hot day and just sleep there for hours and hours and hours. And so my life, our lives were filming Shakespeare, hundreds and hundreds of sit-ups. Filming Shakespeare, hundreds of sit-ups.
So hundreds at a time.
Yeah, you just do hundreds. So you do whatever you can within a confined space. A little bit like probably living on a submarine, I imagine.
You spent 4.5 years tracking one leopard, is that right?
Yeah, that's quite
that
right.
That is right.
Yeah, she was great, yeah.
We found her when
what
she was tiny.
What did that look like? Well, I mean, did you follow the leopard in the car?
We found her when she was 8 days old, and then and she was with her mother. So we just decided to move in with them. And so every day we would find them, or if we had lost them, we would track them and find them. And then just spend as much time with them as possible. So every single day we'd be up at 3:30, 4 in the morning, go out, pick up the tracks, find her mother possibly, and then stay with her the whole day until 9, 10 at night.
How do you know they're her tracks? I mean, couldn't it be another cat's tracks?
Yeah, so every leopard has a different track like yours, so I'd be able to pick your tracks up if I understood your feet. So it's there's a science to it.
We eventually had this incredible relationship with her that, you know, if you spend that amount of time with the cat, and we found her, as Derek said, with 8 days old, so slowly we spent more time with her than her mother. Her mother would go off hunting, maybe 2 days at a time, and we would be that constant. We were always there. And so it came a time that she started looking at us, you know, wondering who we were. And then, as we all know, cats are so curious, she eventually came to investigate us. And once she realized that we were a safe zone for her, we were pretty much a part of the forest, but we were more than that. And we eventually, I think when she got to be about sort of 6 months old, we realized that we had kind of broken a sort of spell that we were more and possibly like surrogate parents, because that's what the way she treated us. You know, often there were times where she was in danger and instead of going back to her den, she would come and go underneath our car.
What did that feel like for you?
You know, it was an incredible privilege. I mean, I think, you know, how can you not enjoy that? But we knew that there was a fine line and we didn't want her to get so complacent around humans that one day it could hurt her.
It's at first gratifying to have that trust, because I think that one of the things we've lost over the, you know, 60,000 years that we've been in this sort of shape and form as humans, is we've lost that trust with wild animals. We've persecuted them for a long, long time. So to have an innocent leopard suddenly break through that and realize that she could trust us, and us specifically, that's very gratifying. But it comes with a huge burden, because then she could walk off to another vehicle, jump into that, and they wouldn't react the same way. So we have to be very careful about that.
I heard a great story about you. I don't know if it's true, but that you, in the pureness of the outdoors at night, sometimes you wouldn't wear any clothes when you're going hunting lion. Is that true?
I didn't know there were cameras on that.
It's the lore.
Now, I think that what we've done, though, is it was quite interesting. Actually, an extension of that is we were trying to understand what it's like to feel like a zebra in the middle of the night, walking through the long grass, knowing that lions could attack you at any time. And so we got in behind, or you were driving, I think, I got in behind a herd of zebras and just walked with them, with the lights off, and it's very, very eerie, knowing that you prey in an environment like that where there's a lot of lions. So I think it is about breaking down those barriers.
So that's why it was worth the risk?
Yes, because I think there's a real danger that as we're talking about Africa, that we present a Disney-fied version of it. What we've always wanted to do is present a real version of it so that we understand the protagonists and what it's like to be a hyena racing into a lion kill, or a lion being attacked or mobbed, or a zebra walking in the night. So we need to feel that. And only once we've felt that and understood it could we write about it in the film with any sense of empathy, I think.
And when you were walking in the moonlight with the zebras, what did that feel like?
Wow. It was actually profound. It's you feel very vulnerable, very, very vulnerable, and that every crack of a grass stalk nearby, you think there's a lion attached to that, or it might be a mouse. And so you, every hair on your body is standing upright. Every sense of survival is crying out to you that you better be alert, and your twitch muscles are already halfway twitched. So you can imagine what it's like to be a zebra. Our defense mechanisms don't allow us to do this all the time. That's why it's so extreme. But zebras and other prey animals are not like that all the time. They're in a fairly relaxed state going into it, and then they have these action moments, and then they forget very quickly. That's the only mechanism. Otherwise, they wouldn't cope. In the same way as combat soldiers can't stay on high alert all the time, because you just wouldn't cope.
What's a key difference between the Disney version of Africa and the real version?
Well, I would say that the glorified romantic version of Africa and African wildlife that's often and even more increasingly presented to us is that nothing bad happens. Is that baby cubs grow up, lion cubs grow up, and they become bigger lions, and they become big, majestic male lions sitting on Pride Rock somewhere. And very, you know, the bad stuff is very often hidden. For instance, you don't often see that, as we showed in one of our films, that a beautiful lion cub of 3 months old can have its back broken by a buffalo and survive like that for a week, struggling, pulling its back legs along. Do we need to know that or not? Not really. I think we, in our films, we try and point to it. We don't linger on it. But I think giving a more balanced view of what happens in the harshness of nature is the very reason that we do our films and that we should all be doing films like this and telling stories, is because the things that go on in nature are parables for the things that go on in our lives. And we need to learn from nature to have balanced and rounded lives ourselves. So when we're children, we think nothing can go wrong. But we need to prepare ourselves for the time when our parents die, or our grandparents die. And one of the reasons we have pets, I think, is so that we can preempt the moment of discovery of death within our own lives. It opens the conversation.
Yeah, you have to understand the life and death struggle that is happening globally, and it's happening not only to the furry creatures out there, but it's happening to the humans. And I think it is important for us to see similarities. You know, we are just another animal species.
I think there are lessons as well beyond simply death. So there are many lessons from the animal world that we can draw on that I think we lose the opportunity of if we just paint the glorified version. So I think that, for instance, we should be learning from elephants about empathy and trust and respect and intelligence and caring and even the ritualization of death, and draw that into our lives. In fact, if we look at what elephants represent and what humans represent, they're very, very similar. We have language, we have concept of past, present, future, all of these things. The one thing that we don't have, or that we do have, sorry, that elephants don't, is the capacity for cruelty.
So do you ever get sick of each other?
Well, I was a bit worried when I was walking with the zebras and the car stopped.
I mean, truly, you know, he's read Hamlet to you over and over again. It's hot, it's sticky. I mean, don't you ever think, you know, maybe I could just go to an air-conditioned movie? I don't really need to do this anymore.
You know, it's very hard to get me out of the field. I mean, especially when we've got to go on a trip. I'm sort of, you know, this is my soul food, being out in the wilderness area. I think we have such a balanced life. We probably have a more balanced life than most people in a relationship. And I think the danger in a relationship when you're living in society, you'll often find there'll be individuals that think they're being caring, but they'll poke holes into your relationship and you start thinking, yeah, damn right, he shouldn't have said that. Whereas Derek and I have to sort everything out ourselves. So communication is key with us in the field, with us, you know, wherever we are. And I think often our communication, because we've got to know each other so well, is that we can sit very silently and not say a word to each other. And all of a sudden one will say, yeah, I agree. And we'll look at each other and go, oh, I didn't even verbalize that, but yeah, you're right, you know, and then we'll talk about it.
So and, if you're given the silent treatment, it doesn't necessarily mean you're mad at him.
Exactly.
Doesn't mean anything to me.
No, and of course, I mean, there's another reason why, you know, you really do have to be on a good relationship. You can't just storm out and say, well, that's it. You know, I'm going to go for a walk and not be with each other, because I think the partnership that we have in the field is vital for understanding the research, the discovery, but also if something goes wrong. So it's key to have a partnership.
We didn't get together and get married so that we could live separate lives. When we started out, we said, you know, we're in love. Hence, we want to spend our lives as close together as possible, for as long as possible. So we looked across at some of our friends who were falling in love around the same time we were, and then they were getting jobs in banks and then spending their most precious, engaging hours of the day with other people. And so we designed our lives the other way around. In fact, all that we do today is really designed around this one premise, that we wanted to spend as much time as possible quality time as possible every single day.
Well, your story is an amazing story of a love affair, but also it's so remarkable that both of you have had a love affair together with wildlife. Do you feel that that's one in a trillion? That both of you found each other, you're both interested in the same thing, you're both doing it 40 years later?
Well, I think the two are intertwined. So I think that we fell in love, and we both had an interest in wildlife, but we went out and developed that and nurtured that interest in wildlife together. It's not as if we had really 100% commitment to the bush and to the wild in parallel. I think we developed that together.
How long would you go without seeing another human being?
Oh.
Gosh, in the 80s and 90s, yeah, it would be forever.
This actually is interesting because we were living way out in the Lunyanti area, northern part of Botswana, and we had arranged, it was before I had an aeroplane, so we had arranged for people to drop food at the nearest airfield for us every 2 weeks. And then we would drive out, collect our food, and then continue. So we had gone about 270 days then without seeing anybody. And we got to the airfield, and our watches had been damaged and broken, but so we were a little bit out of sync. We got to the airfield. There was no food there. And then we heard the plane coming with our food. But we knew we had a problem because as the plane was landing, we backed off into the forest, watched them unload our food so that we didn't have to interact with anybody. And then we went out and got our food once they had taken off. We then realized that perhaps we needed to get out of there.
And did you?
You know, a few months later, yeah.
But of course, it's all changed now. I mean, I suppose now we modernize. There's the internet. We're more connected.
We've got a plane, so I can fly in and get our own food. So we interact more with people now. Yeah. But that was the pinnacle of our reclusive.
Has your success, you've done so many acclaimed movies and books, helped you have, you know, more money so that you can have more comforts, a plane and different things?
So what it has done is it's given us a revenue stream, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And we were just saying the other day, boy, we've never wished for more money. But every now and again, I wish I was a billionaire because we could give so much away. So many of our conservation projects are underfunded, and I'd love to be able to write a big check to save lions forever or to save elephants forever, to move 1,000 rhinos, you know, that sort of thing. So I think that we're getting there. You know, we're able to give more money away because it's just the two of us, so we don't need a legacy of leaving an inheritance to kids or anything else. So our legacy is what we leave for the planet.
That legacy now includes 30 films, many of them Emmy Award winners, a dozen books, hundreds of articles, and powerful fine art photographs. Then there's their Big Cats Initiative, a partnership with National Geographic operating in 27 countries to teach communities that wild cats are worth more to them alive than dead, and that they can coexist peacefully by using better techniques to protect their cattle. The Jouberts also consider one of their greatest successes helping to convince the government of Botswana in 2004 to ban lion hunting, followed some years later by leopard hunting, and finally all hunting, though those laws are not set in stone. And then there is Great Plains Conservation, a company the Jouberts helped launch to provide low-impact ecotourism to support conservation programs and local communities. To achieve all of this, they've sacrificed a lot of physical comfort living in the wild. But Beverly Joubert told Mary Jordan the emotional hardship they've endured at times is worse.
I mean, we can go into deep, dark depression where we look at what's happening on the planet and you think with all this exertion that we're putting into it and yet we're still in the decline, we're still losing species, we still have governments that are unraveling everything and sort of looking at the environment and saying, well, that's not important right now. What is important is industry. But, you know, we can't have one without the other. We have to protect our planet. We have to protect the lungs of the earth, and that's both ocean and forests. And when it seems like you're losing all the time and you're still having safari hunting and killing lions, you take it on personally. But if, what got us both into it is the love for nature. What drives us forward is those bleak moments. They're the ones that push us to say, no, we've got to change this. We have to be able to, you know, stop those atrocities.
In the dark moments when it is depressing and you see the poaching and you've done an enormous amount of work on conservation, do you look at each other and say, you know, maybe it's time we go get a real shower?
Sometimes I think that the solutions are not in having a bar of chocolate or a shower. Yeah. The solutions are in working through it and visualizing two futures and then opting for the better one. And so we go through that exercise quite a lot. You'll say, we've just come across five elephant carcasses with their tusks chopped out. This is devastating and illogical, and it makes us angry. And so then we'll settle down and say, all right, we've got to fight this. So if we retire and have a shower and a couple of bars of chocolate and get out of it because it's too emotionally hard for us, this will continue. So the solution to that problem is us. And then we lean forward into it and then paint a different future.
I can see the moments when it's hot and you have to be patient, but there must be very funny moments that also happen out there. Can you remember one or two?
Gosh. Not one.
There's so many. And in fact, some of our disasters then turn into funny moments. But, you know, every time, now and then, you talk about the heat. We've found a very sandy patch where you can see there's no crocodiles coming into the area. And you sort of, you know, drop into the water and just soak up this beautiful Okavango water and enjoy it. And the next minute you come out and you see that you are covered in leeches. And of course, we always find it really funny when it's on somebody else, but not on yourself.
In one of those open areas, once we were driving along at sunset and a beautiful hard-baked pan, open area. And so I stopped the vehicle and I took Beverly's hand and we went out there at sunset, lions calling in the distance. And we danced a tango on this pan.
Do you have a radio? What kind of music? How do you listen to music?
We had music in our heads.
Yeah, totally music in our heads at that time. But, you know, we don't we don't listen to the radio and we don't listen to music at night. The music that we listen to is really the chorus of what's happening out there. You know, you'll hear a lion roar and then a hyena give its call and then a little jackal and then all the owls would start and all the little bell frogs if you were close to water. And it really is. It's a cacophony of just the most incredible sound. So that is our music.
We had a lot of fun moments with that leopard that we were following.
And we did.
I remember she and her mother were just going through a split up. So it happens to all leopards at a certain time. She was 13 months old. And her mother was, the mother had killed an impala, brought it up a tree. The little one got there and completely messed it up and dropped the impala. Hyenas took it, so it didn't bode well for a peaceful afternoon. And the mother was growling at the little one. And she didn't know, she'd never had this in her life before. And so she came to us once again for support and comfort. And she was lying on the side looking up at Beverly and sort of meowing and then moved away again, tried to get close to her mother, got rejected. So Beverly started to record all of this, and she had a rifle mic with a furry cover on it, and she put it down. And that was enough distraction for this little leopard. She pounced on this thing as if it was a young animal and ripped it away from Beverly. And the two of them were having this tug of war on this cable. The leopard wanted it as much as Beverly.
But eventually I managed to reel her in.
So it is those moments that are lighthearted every day.
I remember once listening to our hyenas crunching sort of in the distance and looking down and going, oh my gosh, you know what they're eating? And they were eating the light meter at the time. I remember it's freezing cold in the winter months. And I just hung my sheepskin jacket at the back where we were sleeping. And the next minute we watched it sort of swing and then pull and go, and looked up and there was a hyena with this one. I was not going to live without my sheepskin jacket. And I just leapt out of the car and ran, only sort of halfway thinking, gosh, what am I doing? But he dropped it and I got my sheepskin jacket back.
We were living in a semi-desert area and in a tent, decent tent. And we left about a half a cup of water inside the tent. Elephant came in, smashed the tent for that half a cup of water, rolled it up, completely destroyed it.
He didn't even get to the water.
No. So then we decided that tents were probably a bad idea, so we built a little grass hut, and it didn't have a door on it. But we had a freezer in there to keep the film stock in. And we went out one night, and we were filming away. When we got in, we found hyena hairs on the bed that he had used as a step to get into the freezer and stole all the film.
So oh, no.
14 rolls of film were taken.
How much work was that was gone?
That was months and months.
Luckily, the one roll of film that did survive, just barely, was groundbreaking proof that hyenas aren't just scavengers, but actually killers. And the noble lion, well, she sometimes steals the kill off the hyenas. The Jouberts had filmed a hyena racing into a zebra herd and taking down a foal. Maybe the hyena that stole their 14 rolls of film was trying to hide the evidence, but he or she was no match for Derek Joubert. He's an expert tracker and managed to follow the thief into the forest, where he recovered the reel. The hyena had punctured the can, but not the black bag that was protecting the undeveloped film. The documentary that features the gruesome baby zebra takedown, by the way, is called Eternal Enemies, Lions and Hyenas, and it is extraordinary. There are shots that could only be captured by someone who lives where the wild things are and understands them well enough to anticipate their actions. Although the Jouberts are tremendous risk takers by any reasonable standards, they managed to avoid bodily harm for a long, long time. But their lucky streak came to an end in 2016. Mary Jordan asked them to share the very scary story that took place 15 months before this interview, and they did, with impressive equanimity.
We were actually in our camp, and we were going from our tent to the main area. We both had torches. We were moving along a path that we've done, you know, over 30 years. And out of the darkness, all that we heard, we had less than 3 seconds to react, was the snort of this very irate individual buffalo bull. And he came charging towards us. Derek and I were walking together, and he just sort of came right to us. My instant response was to stay as quiet as possible, and he will go away from us, because we clearly, you know, not pinning him in at all. We're not putting him in a corner. And Derek's was at that time where he saw that there was nothing to change the plight of this buffalo. Derek put his hands up to sort of try and scare him away. But he hit Derek on the side of his body. Derek went flying, you know, the force of a one-ton creature. And Derek went flying and landed down the path. And then the last thing I saw was this enraged eye, the white of his eyes. You could see he was angry and fearful at the same time. And he hit me straight in the face. And that was the last thing I remembered, because I, you know, he concussed me. But I woke up on top of his horns, and I was impaled. At the time, I didn't know I was impaled. And when I woke up, I remember instantly thinking, this is interesting. I'm galloping with an animal. And then it came all back that I'm probably on the buffalo. And I actually did give a silent plea of help within my mind. And then I said to myself, I was just so amazed that I was alive. And I said to myself 3 times, I'm alive, I'm alive, I'm alive. And then an overwhelming blackness went over me. And I suspect that is when Derek was trying to, you know, run after the buffalo. But I think we hear it from Derek's side because we both had different perspective of those first moments.
So 2,000-pound buffalo puts his horn right through you, went in one side, came out the other.
Sort of. It didn't come out. Yeah. It went in under my armpit, through the chest, carried on going through the throat. He lacerated inside in the throat, and it broke 21 bones in my cheek. My eye orbit collapsed, and then, of course, it shattered my collarbone, obviously, you know, getting on that route.
But then it came out the same way.
Yeah. So when I hit that
over... How did it come out?
So what happened? The buffalo hit me first, broke some ribs, cracked my pelvis, and then impaled Beverly. And I looked up and I saw her being dragged off really into the dark. And so I got up and I chased after the two of them, shortened the distance, and calculated, I guess, or instinctively worked this out, landed on my left foot and kicked the buffalo with my right. And I kicked it in a spot where we later found out it actually had a wound, and that wound split open. So when that happened, he then tried to get to me, and he tossed his head and threw Beverly off. If that hadn't have happened, Beverly would have been dragged off into the bush, and we would have heard hyenas later on. So then she crumpled down at my feet, and you remember I put my finger under her nose to see if she was still alive. And she was.
And I came, so I didn't come round that I could speak to Derek, but I was still unconscious. But I remember, again, in my mind, I sort of said to myself, my gosh, Derek thinks I'm dead. So, you know, I knew that what he was with...
Did you think she was going to die right there?
No. But as I was doing that, I heard the buffalo coming back. So we got a second chance of dying. So I jumped over Beverly and I ran towards the buffalo and drew him away. He sort of followed me at a 45-degree angle, knocked me down again and ran off. And then I went back and I tested Beverly again and then realized that, and I often say this is probably the hardest decision of my life then, because you told in first aid that you shouldn't move the patient. But I couldn't imagine not moving Beverly, leaving her in the dark there and going to camp for help.
Yeah.
So I bent down and picked her up, cradled her head in my armpit, in my crook of my elbow, and then carried her for about 150 meters. And then the pain in my hip kicked in, and so then I fell down. And Beverly then woke up and said, "Don't pick me up, I can walk."
Did you fall together?
He fell, but it wasn't hard on me at all. Maybe it was enough as a shock, you know, to get me to wake up. And I kind of just unfolded my body, not knowing if there was anything broken or not.
I wanted at that stage to say, you could have told me that 150 meters back.
And of course, I started walking. Obviously, I was being supported by Derek, and there was a lot of blood coming out. I was bleeding sort of and swallowing the blood, you know, down into my stomach from my face and from my nose. And we walked probably about, roughly the same distance Derek had, and then got to this wooden deck. And I stopped there, and Derek wanted to still get me into camp and get into a cool area. And I said to him, I can't go any further. And so I just slid on the ground, and that's where I stayed for 11 hours.
Why 11 hours?
Because it's dark in the Okavango. They've got a policy, there's no exterior lights, is what I really am saying. It's dark everywhere at nighttime. But they don't want anybody flying at nighttime for security reasons, you know, for poaching, for many reasons.
Safety reasons.
So and
we couldn't get a helicopter in.
So you called, and they said, okay, we'll come get you in 11 hours?
Said we'll catch you at dawn.
At dawn, yeah.
We had communications with the president of Botswana, and he was going to come up in his helicopter to get us. But there was a cyclone in the town where the helicopter was, so he couldn't get off the ground.
There were many things. It was almost against all odds that I was going to survive, because, you know, to spend, to have that experience and actually be impaled and then pushed off the horn. I mean, a lot of the surgeons said it was remarkable. If they had put a surgical instrument into me and gone the same route and brought it out, they more than likely would have cuts the carotid artery or the esophagus, because that's exactly where the horn had gone. And so they were amazed, that part that I survived. They were absolutely sort of flabbergasted that I made that I survived those 11 hours.
What did you do during those 11 hours?
Oh, no, I was applying first aid, you know, medical treatment through all
like what?
Oh, the biggest thing is I had to stop the bleeding. So what I was able to do, I tried to stop that bleeding. Ultimately, what I had to do is wrap a pad and bandage around my fist and insert it into her chest and change it every 20 minutes, but basically left it there for about 6 hours to try and get that bleeding to stop. So 5 liters of blood, you know, she lost. And then at 2:32 she died, and I had to bring her back from that. And then at 4:40 she died again. But the journey through that was really much more an exercise in first aid, but also in keeping everybody calm. I think that when I had my hand inside Beverly's chest, I realized that her lung had collapsed and that her collarbone was smashed. But even then, I had no idea how deep the horn had gone and that it had traveled up into her skull.
Go back to what you just said. You died twice that night, so your heart stopped. Do you remember that? People talk about this feeling like they're gone and then coming back. Did you feel that?
You know, I don't recall anything that is, you know, this long tunnel or anything like that. Before that moment, I had got to a point where I realized that the amount of blood that I was losing, and, you know, obviously my body was getting weaker. I said to Derek, please don't overdose me with painkillers. And he said, why? And I said, you know, I just want to be fully conscious. I want to be fully conscious because I think this might be, you know, the last time. And who knows, when that time comes, I want to be able to say goodbye.
They finally got help at 7 in the morning and started the journey back to South Africa. But on the plane, Beverly crashed again and lost all vital signs. They revived her once again, this time with a good shot of adrenaline in her heart. During her 3 months in the hospital, they told Derek, who of course was badly injured himself, that Beverly would never be able to eat again. In fact, she can, though it took 8 months for her to be able to open her mouth fully.
What was your recovery like? You had many operations. First of all, if anyone's looking at you right now, you look like nothing happened. You're famously good looking. They were talking, I've heard many people on there, you know, they're out in the bush and they look like models, both of you. No, people would never even know all that you've been through, but you have been through a lot. What's the lesson you learned from that near-death experience?
Well, the big lesson for us is that, and I say this, that all you have to do is spend a moment holding the hand of person you love as she's dying or has died, and wishing, praying for another minute, another second, another month, another year, to realize that if you get it, and in this case we did, you're not going to waste another moment with anything that's irrelevant. So for us, what that means is, if it's not saving the planet or doing the sort of stuff that we really need to do or having fun, then it's not worth getting out of bed for. So that's really where we're like laser sharp focused now.
Absolutely. Are you going to go back to the...
We have been back.
Back. We started filming again in August. We also relocated a lot of rhinos. We haven't spoken about, you know, our Rhinos Without Borders program. But that is, a couple of years ago, we said that we would move 100 rhinos from the highest perching zone in one country into the lowest perching zone into another. And we started that journey. We've now moved 77. And we've got 16 babies that are born in the wild, which is really exciting. But my first project back was, first of all, going back to the area that's the accident happened, coming, you know, to terms with it. I wanted to make sure I had no demons. And then sitting with a buffalo herd and photographing their horns, obviously the horn was the key part that went into my body, and all was fine. But we spent a fair amount of time doing that. And then we moved 16 rhinos in that August as well. And it was phenomenal soul food for me. I really felt that I was back. I might not have been as strong as I wanted to be, but it really was quite a challenge because a lot of the moving was through the night. And I think we dropped into bed at 4 a.m. And as I went into bed, I thought, well, against all odds of me surviving and really being deconstructed in less than 3 seconds, and here I am. And sometimes, you know, we pinch each other and we sort of say, my gosh, isn't it outstanding that this is where we are? We did survive. So right now, I probably see it a little bit as a dream. But, you know, we don't choose life lessons. And I find that I now, unlike my solitary years, just Derek and I, and not needing anybody, I still don't need anybody. But I'm immensely appreciative of every human being that we have touched and has touched our hearts.
You have so many gorgeous books. There's one here, The Eye of the Leopard, that is just stunning. I mean, it looks like you were 1 foot from their eyes. So, so amazing. But there was this one line here in this book that said, we all have wild eyes or that passion for wildness within us. But from this, creativity is sometimes born and nurtured.
Right. So fundamentally, I believe that we all have a wildness in us. We have that spirit of freedom, that wildness, and it feeds our creativity, and our creativity heals us. So in many ways, that wild spirit that we have within us is healing. And I think that, you know, Beverly's story is because she had a wild spirit and a spirit that didn't want to be put down then. And I think that from that, all things are born. Creativity, healing, happiness, love, cause.
Is there some image that you would still like to capture, the elusive?
Oh, gosh.
What is it that you would still like to do or see?
I think there is still that image out there that we hunt every day. That if blown up on a big billboard somewhere in New York, would deliver the message to everybody in the world that would be convincing, that everybody would say, ah, we get it. We need to take care of the planet. That one image could do it, and that's what we are after every day.
That's Derek and Beverly Joubert, award-winning filmmakers, photographers, conservationists, and National Geographic explorers in residence, based in Botswana. In 2009, they appeared at the Academy of Achievement International Summit at the Singita Private Game Reserve in South Africa, and they spoke with Washington Post reporter Mary Jordan for this podcast in June of 2018. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. What It Takes is funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening.